This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Islamic militants are slowly gaining more control of Iraq. A group known as the Islamic State is taking control in the northern part of the country. It has made Mosul a de facto capital and has driven thousands of Christians out of the city. But the battle is not sectarian alone. It is political, and ISIS continues to gain more territory. As it does, U.S. hopes for a united, multicultural Iraq are fading. We are taking your calls today. We especially want to hear from North Carolina veterans about post-war Iraq. You can call us at 877-962-9862. You can tweet us at hashtag SOTIraq. Joining me first from Baghdad is BBC correspondent G.R. Goal. Welcome to the State of Things, G.R.
Hi.
Tell us sort of what's the latest on the ground now in Iraq?
Well, we were in the Kurdish region just yesterday, and the day before yesterday we spent some time actually near Mosul, as a matter of fact the last checkpoint in the Kurdish controlled territory. Many people, they were escaping Mosul, they were Christians. Most of them, they were walking. When I asked them actually why you walk, you could have drive, they say in the ISIS checkpoints they took our car, pretty much all their belongings. They just let them take an ID with them. So the situation for Christian in Iraq, it doesn't look good. And today there is a very old monastery in Mosul, Mara Behnam is a monastery. It was taken over, and obviously those monks who reached Kurdish region, they told Kurdish Peshmerga that pretty much they just let them take their clothes, nothing else. They left everything behind. And while in Baghdad there is still negotiation behind the scene is going on in about forming the government. So the situation is pretty much the same. ISIS took over those region, a big chunk of the country. They are controlling that region so far. And Iraqi army hasn't been able to take over or at least gain some of the territories, take control of those territories which ISIS almost 5-6 weeks ago took over.
Apart from driving out those who are living in that part of the world, particularly Christians, what then happens when ISIS takes control? What's happening in those parts of in that part of the country?
Well, Mosul is has many significant historical Christian historical places there, and Christians are very old. I mean, they've been living there for thousands of years. I mean, more than thousands of years, 1700 years at least, the history traced them back. So for them, many of them, they left the country after 2003 when Saddam Hussein fell during the invasion of Iraq. And there was this around 60 to 30,000 of them left in that region. But since last month when ISIS took over, many people left their homes, pretty much you could say all of them. But at the beginning, ISIS seems to be kind to them. They say, we have nothing to do with you. You can come back and live like normal. But many of them, many families who couldn't afford to stay in other region, in Kurdish region, they went back to Mosul. But obviously, since last Friday when they issued this fatwa that convert to Islam or you will be beheaded, many of them, again, they try to escape. And some of those people who left behind, I talked to those families who recently escaped Mosul. They told me many of them, they are hiding themselves in their Muslim neighbors' houses, or they pretend they have converted to Islam. And many more, they are trying to leave the city. And obviously, some of the ISIS militants take their belonging as a spoils of war, pretty much same way it was in the early days of Islam in Hejaz, which is Saudi Arabia at the time.
Yeah, well, you talked about the militaries, the Iraqi military's inability to regain these territories. Is that a surprise to observers there in Iraq?
Well, I think yes, it was in a way, because Iraqi army never, they were never been tested. In fact, Iraqi army, yes, they were in many different places. They were well equipped with American-made military, weapons, and a lot of people thought they are capable. But nobody thought, in a matter of day, they would lose such a significant chunk of the country, and not only leave, actually, they left their weapons behind. As a matter of fact, in the front line with the Kurdish Peshmerga, we were there near between Erbil and Mosul, most of their weapons, Peshmerga, were American-made, and normally they don't have that kind of weapons. And I asked the commander, I said, how did you get this? Actually, when ISIS attacked this region, Iraqi army, their commander, their soldier, all left their weapons behind and run away. So, because Iraqi army is like a mosaic, there is a lot of Sunni in the army, Kurds and Shia, and seems many of those groups, they feel that they don't want to get themselves killed for a government, obviously, they do not believe in. But obviously, the government trying to regain the control and changing each, the Prime Minister Maliki changed the commanders of the army in hopes of, make some gain. And of course, after the fatwa of Ayatollah Sistani, one of the grand Ayatollah calling on people to join the army to defend the country, many militia, Shia militia, volunteered and joined the army. They are working side by side with the army. But so far, the army hasn't been able to retake those regions, has fallen to the hand of ISIS.
All right. Well, American troops withdrew from Iraq in December of 2011. Joining us now are two veterans of the Iraq War. Matt Victoriano was a Marine sniper who served two tours of duty in the early years of the war. He rejoins us now. Matt, welcome back. Good to see you again.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Lewis Hendricks was an Army captain who helped move American supplies during the troop withdrawal of 2011. He is now the post commander of the Veterans of Foreign Wars at the American Legion in Chapel Hill. Lewis Hendricks, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Bruce Gentleson, a political science and public policy professor at Duke. And Bruce had been a foreign policy advisor to the staff of the Obama and the Clinton administrations. Bruce Gentleson, welcome to you.
Good to be with you.
Matt Victoriano, let me start with you. You were there early on, 2004, in Fallujah. Take us back there. Give us a sense of your day-to-day operations in 2004 and what it looked like then.
In 2004, I did some convoy patrols out of Camp Fallujah, down the main road between Fallujah and Ramadi, and then I spent the rest of my time in Mahmoudiya, just south of Baghdad. And most of my time was spent trying to do counter-ambush operations along that route. It was the main supply route, and the supply fuel convoys supplying our troops were getting hit quite frequently. So I spent most of my time out along that road doing missions like that, or doing joint patrols with squads around the base to prevent people from firing rockets or mortars into the base. I had operated in that area a year before, right after the tail end of the invasion, and it had been okay. It started to get worse and worse. By the time I went back a year later, we couldn't actually go down the road going south to where I'd been at the power plant in Iskandaria. It was so heavily occupied by the insurgents that you're guaranteed to get hit by IEDs every time you went down there. So they controlled the area, IEDs, rockets, mortars.
We're talking about Iraq in the post-withdrawal era on the state of things. Matt Victoriano is with us, a former veteran, as is Lewis Hendricks. So, Lewis Hendricks, take us forward to the time we withdrew. This was the time, the most difficult period for the U.S. to gain control of Iraq. By 2011, it was time for us to leave. You were helping with logistics then. What was the scene then?
So, it was, to put it in a small phrase, would be organized chaos as far as getting it. 2011 was primarily a logistical mission in Iraq, getting everything and everybody out as safely as possible. So it was collapsing all the minor fobs down into the major fobs, and then
fobs are
forward operating base.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a bunch of them, so you're kind of collapsing those down into the major ones, and then we were pushing down south, as most people saw in November. We moved everything over into Kuwait. So the life on a fob was that year started off fine. And then as you start collapsing things down, your, I guess the standard of living that we had, slowly degraded to the end.
Bruce Gentleson is a policy advisor. Colin Powell famously said at the beginning of this adventure, you break it, you own it. And the thing about ownership is you keep it. And, of course, at some point you have to withdraw. There's been a lot of criticism about setting a withdrawal date, that's the sort of the cause of all of this. Is there any way to withdraw from a situation like that with so many different sects in which this would not happen?
Well, I think the issue is less that we withdrew at the end of 2011, that we didn't use the time and the leverage we had while we were there, both during the Bush and the Obama administrations, to really make sure that Prime Minister Maliki, you know, the Shia are a majority, but the whole arrangement was supposed to be inclusiveness, particularly bringing the Sunnis in. When we did the surge in 2007, 2008, it was really an effort to try to work with some of the Sunnis who at that time were alienated by sort of the predecessor to ISIS, and then for Maliki to bring them into the military, to give them civil service jobs, and that didn't happen. And staying beyond 2011 wouldn't have changed that. This is fundamentally a political problem. The Iraqi army, as your reporter was saying, you know, basically folded against ISIS. And ISIS is not that formidable a military force. It's very corrupt at the officer level. And people didn't have any sense in that army that they really believed in what they were fighting for.
On the state of things today, talking about post-war or post-withdrawal Iraq, North Carolina veterans Matt Victoriano and Lewis Hendricks are with us, as well as political science professor Bruce Gentleson and BBC Iraq correspondent G.R. Gohl. Our conversation continues. You can join us at 877-962-9862. We're particularly interested in hearing from veterans here in North Carolina. Tweet us at hashtag SOTIraq on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. Broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today we're talking about Iraq with BBC correspondent G.R. Gohl. Veterans Matt Victoriano and Lewis Hendricks are here. Matt was a Marine deployed to Fallujah in 2004, involved in combat operations there. Lewis, an Army captain deployed in 2011 to help organize the troop withdrawal at a base north of Baghdad. And also with us is Bruce Gentleson, a political science and public policy professor at Duke, who has been a public policy, or I should say foreign policy advisor to the staffs of both Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. We want to hear from you as well. 877-962-9862. Especially interested in hearing from veterans. You can call us or tweet us at hashtag SOTIraq. Lewis, you know, you just heard GR talk about the fact that that ISIS is picking up a lot of weapons left behind that the Iraqi military is leaving behind. But we, at our withdrawal, had to leave behind a lot of stuff too, right?
No, that's absolutely correct. It was you kind of had to determine what was worth taking back and what was leaving behind. And, you know, I think the figures are in the billions as far as dollars of equipment left behind, ranging from desks and office equipment up to full-size pickup trucks to our up-armored Humvees.
And I guess the hope is, I mean, you're leaving. It's a relatively stable place, so you make this kind of mathematical or you know, financial calculation. Is it more expensive to take it or leave it? But you're hoping it all stays in friendly hands, and you can't know that this is going to happen.
Right. No, that's exactly right. It's, you know, how much does it cost to bring a Ford F-150 across the water? Makes more sense to probably leave it there from a taxpayer standpoint. But, yeah, you're hoping it stays in the right hands. And like we've seen recently, some of the stuff is falling into ISIS hands.
Matt, you know, Bruce Gentleson was talking about what he considers a missed opportunity, a political missed opportunity to ensure that multiculturalism had become integrated into Iraqi politics. It hadn't by the time we were left, possibly responsible for what we're seeing now. But multiculturalism, in order to instill something like that, requires some kind of cultural competence. You need to know who the people are where in the place where you're occupying to know how to make that work. You developed a very close relationship with your interpreter and I think developed a pretty good understanding, as one can, about sort of what was going on there culturally.
Yeah, I did. Well, it started my first tour with my first interpreter, Sala, and he went out of his way to help us out. He'd been a major in the Air Force and studied in England. He was killed by a roadside bomb after we left. Helping out another Army unit. A second time, I went back. My interpreter, Mikey, he's a young 19-year-old, really blew me away with how much he knew about the U.S. and his English capabilities. But I spent my free time when I wasn't on missions picking his brain and learning Iraqi Arabic from him, and we stayed in touch ever since then.
What was your sense about sort of the general American understanding, either at home, but I guess in particular among your comrades in arms, the people you're fighting with, in terms of our understanding of who we were dealing with?
We are pretty much clueless. My first time, I mean, we were Marines. Our job was to fight. It wasn't to restore a population or to help rebuild infrastructure. We were really at the boundary between the southern end of the Sunni Triangle, which is, you know, Sunni population, and Shia population. And without knowing that difference, we would have been in a lot of trouble. Our interpreters helped us to see what the dividing lines were, to gauge the body language of the populace, to be able to understand what they were talking about, the context of what they were talking about, and guide us through a lot of situations where otherwise we probably would have ended up dead.
Bruce Gentleson, this question of cultural competence, the body language of the people you're working with, is it realistic to expect that you can go in? I mean, you talked about saying, well, what we needed was sort of a more multicultural government, but that comes from a sort of a history of liberal democracy in European culture. Do you walk into somebody else's country with a completely different history and say, here's the PowerPoint on liberal democracy, now make it work and we'll be out in 4 years?
Yeah, no, that's not at all what I was saying. I think what Matt just spoke to was really quite extraordinary. Many members of the military, you know, at the local level really worked hard to build relations with the people in those areas. And in fact, your quote of Colin Powell and the Pottery Barn quote was his reason for not going into Iraq in the first place. What I meant simply was not some sort of kumbaya between the groups there, but fundamentally just simply a power sharing. That the Sunnis and the Kurds would get their shares of power. And that doesn't require everybody sort of reaching some common sense of, you know, who they are and why they can get along. But it's a fundamental pragmatic calculation that when there's been reconciliation in countries, that's the way that it's happened. It happened to a certain extent in Bosnia. In some of the African countries where things have simmered down, it's happened there. So this wasn't for us to tell them how to do. It was rather for us to use our leverage to make it clear to Maliki that our support was contingent upon him finding ways to bring others into the sharing of power, at least to a sufficient degree that they were invested in the system.
How did that work? You were in the Clinton administration, and I don't know if you were there during the war in Kosovo, the U.S.-led battle there. But it seemed to me that the U.S. moved with a deft hand in sort of keeping its distance from groups that it was supporting within Serbia to bring down Milosevic and being very careful not to become associated or to make that association known in order to do just what you described, allow the people of Serbia to create a new government in the ashes of what they had hoped to be going in, the end of the Milosevic regime. Am I right about that? And are these two very different approaches, if you compare Serbia with what we've done in Iraq?
No, they are different. So you take two dimensions of what happened in the 90s in the former Yugoslavia. You know, first was with Bosnia, which after the war and after efforts at peacekeeping, there was never a U.S. occupation. Through diplomacy led by the late Richard Holbrooke, a deal was struck. The leaders of the three major groups, all of whom would have preferred to go on without sharing power with the other, realized that they had no choice. And then in 98-99, with Kosovo, it was largely an air war for about 3 months. It was a NATO operation, not just a U.S. operation. And in fact, there too, Kosovo was a little different because ultimately it's been trying to make itself an independent country separate from Syria. But neither of these cases involved the full offensive of hundreds of thousands of troops, you know, an eight-year occupation in a region. And not only is the problem in Iraq coming from the groups in Iraq, but ISIS really got its foothold in Syria and has moved from Syria back into Iraq. So the degree of success, I don't want to overstate the success in the Balkans, but it was, you know, successful. People aren't killing each other anymore. It's a very different strategy than what we pursued by invading Iraq.
G.R. Gohl, let's get a sense of the political situation now in the Maliki government. Obviously, we're focused on the military operations there, but what is going on politically behind the scenes? So what are we hearing from the government, and what do you think is happening to the Maliki regime itself? Can it survive?
Well, the Kurds and Sunni, definitely, they don't want Mr. Maliki to to again, you know, put his name forward for prime minister for the third round, because many people believe what Iraq is at this moment because of his policies and alienating Shia, Sunni, and of course they have a big problem with the Kurds at that moment. And even before this, what happened in those Sunni areas, the Kurds had a massive problem with them. Since January, Iraqi central government has refused to give the Kurds their share of the budget, which is 17%, and by now is almost about more than $12 billion. And I was talking to some of the Kurdish officials in northern Iraq. They said they have hosting actually around 1 million refugees from Syria and Iraq, and they don't have budget to take care of them. On the other hand, some Shia groups within Mr. Maliki coalition themselves, they are not happy with Mr. Maliki, but he's insisting to run. But in the same time, there is some sort of negotiation going on behind the scene. Last week, they agreed on the Speaker of the Parliament, which traditionally, since 2004, has been Sunni. Salim Jabouri, a Sunni politician, was elected as the Speaker of the Parliament, which is, according to constitution, is the first step toward forming the government, because first they have to choose the new parliament, choose the House Speaker, and then they should choose President of the country, and then the President put the name of the head, the leader of a political party which has the most seat. So far the first step has been taken, and I think the Kurdish coalition, they are right now looking to put forward a name today or in the coming days to run for the president, replace President Jalal Talabani, who has been in hospital since December 2012 and returned just a few days ago to Soleimania, Kurdistan. So if the Kurds agree on one name and this person in the parliament get the vote of confidence, become the president, and most likely we will be witnessing in the next coming weeks, names will be put forward for prime ministers. But so far we haven't heard anything that Mr. Maliki wouldn't run, and I think one of the obstacle on the way to form the government is Kurds, Sunni, and some faction within the Shia coalition, they are not happy with Mr. Maliki to run. That's why some names like Ahmed Chalabi or Hussein Shahristani from the Shia community are, people say most likely those names might be put forward. And on the Kurdish side, they're talking about Barham Saleh, the former deputy prime minister and a Kurdish politician, might be nominated for president to replace President Talabani.
Bruce Gentleson, do you think a political solution is still possible?
I think it needs to be. It's a necessary element. It's not going to solve everything. I think right now the goal, and I think the United States, in working with some of our allies in the region, which are Sunni governments in Saudi, in the United Arab Emirates, and many other countries, are trying, frankly, to prevent ISIS from going further, from taking over Baghdad. And it's taking way too long. My colleague, the guest, was right that they're still talking, but it's been a month now, and Maliki's still in place. And so the credibility of any change in the government now from a Sunni perspective and from a Kurdish perspective, the Kurds have been building their own sort of civil society and state since the early 1990s, the first Gulf War, and when there was a UN peacekeeping force to protect them. Now, the credibility of it just gets less and less the longer it takes, even if it's a different name than Maliki.
Well, we do want to hear from veterans about sort of how you're taking all of this in, this news for those of you who have served and risked your lives and lost friends and loved ones. So we do want to hear from you. We've gotten a couple of tweets. Tingen Taxidermy says, "I'm still proud of what we did in Iraq. I'm ashamed of the current administration for ruining it with poor policy." Flagship WMG says, "It's a mess. The president dishonored all the troops who gave their lives by letting Baghdad fall." Those are a couple of opinions. We'd be happy to hear more. We'll take your phone calls as well at 877-962-9862. Matt Victoriano, sort of, how do you feel taking all this news?
It's upsetting, but I mean, I saw it coming. It only took a couple months in Iraq in 2003 to see that this is going to be the end state. You can't go into that area and expect to put in a democracy and do what we did. It was a failed policy from the beginning. It was a failed policy throughout. I think there are things that President Obama could have done to mitigate I think, like Mr. Jennison said, it was leverage. We had to put leverage on Maliki to do the right thing. We didn't do it. We didn't have the intel assets in there that we should have. We pulled them all out and let it fall apart. My focus right now is to get my interpreter and all the other interpreters out. We left them behind, and they're getting their heads cut off and shot in the head. And, you know, I get to talk to my interpreter every day and hear the stories, you know, hear about his neighbors getting shot, and he's in hiding, and that's what irritates me.
You have an effort underway to get Mikey out, right?
I do, yeah. I started an initial GoFundMe campaign and gave me hope because a lot of people donated to that and gave me enough money to where I was able to help secure his safety to some degree within the country. I think, unfortunately, because of the CIA's suitcase policy of, you know, endless amounts of cash, the rates to do things more efficiently over there are so high that they're out of my reach. So I have to do things a little bit differently and use a little bit of money that I've gotten to work things. But fortunately, we're getting some documents set up and we're trying to get him out of the country.
We're talking about Iraq after the U.S. pullout. On the state of things, Matt Victoriano is one of my guests. He served in Iraq, as did Lewis Hendricks. Lewis, we got another tweet from, again, Tingen Taxidermy. Hugs and cheers from the civilians when we rolled through the streets in Baghdad in 2003. Politics created and ruined it all. We saw those jubilant Iraqis, but by 2011, you noticed that there was a kind of a mixed reaction to the U.S. presence.
Yeah, I think when you're an occupying force for that long, even the people that support what you initially were doing, they're not going to – you're still occupying their country and you're a foreign army occupying their country, so they're not going to be happy about that. So, yeah, we were seeing even right outside of our bases and stuff, we would have small kids throwing rocks at convoys, things like that. So, yeah, I think they were – I guess they had kind of, like the American public, had kind of grown tired of it all.
On the state of things, we are talking about Iraq now in the era of after the U.S. troop withdrawal. On the phone with us now is Taylor from Fayetteville. Hello, Taylor.
How's it going?
It's going good. You have a comment for us or a question?
Just a comment. I was in northern Iraq right outside of Kirkuk in 2010, 2011. And when all the Day of Rage protests were kicking off, the Kurds, the Peshmerga, actually set up blocking positions around Kirkuk City to protect it because they didn't feel the Iraqi army would do that. And about 3 years later, it seemed to me that they moved into the same positions and that they've been planning for a long time to take back their cultural homeland, their headquarters, city of Kirkuk, protect those oil fields. And we had a great relationship with the Kurds, with the Peshmerga. They were great fighters, and they were dedicated fighters and just seemed to be such a higher-quality soldier than the Iraqi soldiers in general.
All right. Thank you, Taylor. Is there a question? I'll ask you this question, Bruce Gentleman, from the policy standpoint of trying to put together an army, a kind of an army of people who now have to commit to this new thing that hasn't existed in their experience before, this new Iraqi government. Is that a practical concern? Can you imagine people laying down their lives for this entity that hasn't been part of your historical experience?
Well, I think the point that your caller made about the Kurds is a really good one because they are a distinct group. If you go back to World War I, they felt they should have gotten their state out of that settlement, and they didn't. And they're part of Turkey. They're part of Iraq. They're a part of Iran as well. And so it really was after the first Gulf War in 1991, under President George H.W. Bush and with U.N. authorization and 27 nations fighting with us, that after that, the Kurds were protected. And so it's been over two decades in which they've had an opportunity to build the kind of loyalty and skill that the caller was talking about, build a civil society, you know, not a democracy, but something where people feel that their leaders take their interest into account. In the rest of Iraq, once we were involved, the best we could do is have some, you know, sort of effort of the Sunni and Shia to find a way just to, you know, work together. You know, they're not going to go marry their children to each other. They're not going to necessarily share dinner. But that was what we had to do. We had to find some way for the Shia majority to share power. And they didn't. And then moreover, they put their own corrupt, inefficient officers into the officer positions which is what the enlisted men who put down their arms and just ran away, they had no confidence in their own leadership. Once we were involved, and again, you can go back to the debate about whether we should have done it in the first place, but once we were involved, we could have done better than we have, and I think there's plenty of blame to go around for that.
Is some of that knowing what you're talking about now, that once we leave, we're going to, before you go in, when we leave, we're going to have to bring these groups together and come up with a power-sharing plan and therefore a means for teaching this or understand what our leverage might be, because we can't get out of there until we know that this power-sharing is in place. I mean, isn't that what you need to know going in?
Well, you do. And once you're in, there was a lot of efforts in the intelligence community and in the State Department around 2002, 2003, when people kind of saw this coming, to basically lay out this is what it's going to take. And, to have decision makers say, well, if that's what it's going to take, A, is it really doable? Or is it doable at a cost in lives that we're prepared to absorb and with support from the American public? And then when we've had the opportunities, I don't think staying another 5 years, Maliki was using our presence, unfortunately, as an excuse not to do the inclusiveness, as an excuse to run things his own way, thinking that somehow we would stay till things were stable. And in his own sort of logic, if he kept things like a little unstable, maybe we'd stay longer. Yeah. Well, that didn't work for him.
Bruce,
for
I've got to go, but I want to thank all of you for being in the program. Bruce Gentleson from Duke, Matt Vittoriano, a veteran in Fallujah in 2004, and Bruce and also Lewis Hendricks, also a veteran who left in 2011. Just ahead on the state of things, what animals can teach us about dating. Stay tuned.